Welcome to the Ministry Collaborative Podcast,
an ongoing conversation
with ministry leaders
about embracing complexity
and uncertainty
with joy
and faithfulness.
Hey, folks, this is Adam with the Ministry Collaborative. I'm sitting here with my colleagues, friends, Jennifer Watley Maxell, and my new friend, Dr. Gigi Kanyezi, who is out on the West Coast, and we're going to be spending some time today talking in line with a series that we've been kind of in for the last couple of months now, talking about spiritual formation. But on today, we're going to enter in from a little bit of a different angle and talk about the need for spiritual formation for those who've encountered trauma, either personal or who are processing trauma across generations. That may be something that some of our listeners might not be familiar with that I think Jennifer and Gigi are well equipped to talk about with us today. Before we jump into the conversation, Dr. G, tell us a little bit about your context and your past and where you've done your study and research and kind of what you're up to right now.
Yeah, first of all, y'all, it is such a treat to be with you. Thank you for the honor of having me. So I am half Brazilian. My dad is an immigrant from Brazil. I'm half Amish, which racially is white. So I'm a brown woman, and I grew up in predominantly Black East Oakland. And that is probably the single most formative part of my story in terms of shaping the woman that I become. Some years later, went to seminary. And when I went to seminary, I declared my emphasis to be intercultural ministry because at the time, wasn't no degree or emphasis that had anything to do with justice. That was closest I could get. So when I declared that emphasis, intercultural ministry, I found out that part of the requirement is that I need to go somewhere overseas for part of a year to do an internship along the lines with what I'm passionate about, what I foresee myself doing in my life's work. And so I chose to go to South Africa. Lo and behold, I went. I fell in love with Soweto, came back just long enough to do my oral exam to finish my Master's Divinity, and then I relocated. It was intended to be indefinite. I was intending to stay there for the rest of my days. That's not quite how things worked out, but I was there for 10 years. And really, along all these adult years from not just undergrad, really high school, all the way into going to South Africa, I have been living at the intersection of liberative faith, so decolonizing faith, healing racial trauma, and beloved community. Those three things. That is the intersection I live at. But when I went to South Africa for that decade, I was living in Soweto, the largest township in South Africa. And by definition, in South Africa, a township, which was created during apartheid, it's by definition 100% Black. Living in that context for a decade, I began to understand trauma from a different lens. Not just my own personal experience of trauma in my own life, but I was living in a community, a geographic familial community that was not just traumatized, it was intergenerationally traumatized, the entire community, which means it was also collectively traumatized. And at that time, we're talking, I got there in 2008, I left in 2017, there was very little out there on collective trauma, which also means there was very little out there on collective healing. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a whole lot out there on intergenerational trauma either. On so many levels, Soweto changed me. One of the things that fundamentally changed for me was how I and we understand trauma and how we approach healing it.
Wow.
So when I came back and my brain was really processing what I had experienced growing up in East Oakland, you know, it's the birthplace of the Black Panther Party, and then spending a decade in Soweto and living as two totally different races of people, because in the U.S. my entire life I've been brown, and then I got to Soweto, and in the township in South Africa, I'm viewed as white. I might as well be blonde hair and blue eyed kind of white, but in the cities and the suburbs, I'm viewed as colored, which is brown. So when I came back and I realized, okay, hold on. I have just lived as two different races of people. What? Not only is that just bizarre, but that exposes the farce, the lie, the myth that we call race. Mm-hmm. And so all of this led me to go back to school. My sense of calling really clarified. Mm-hmm. I ended up going to Howard. So I did a degree program in healing racial trauma, where I integrated the whole theology and ministry program at Howard School of Divinity. I integrated that with the clinical side of healing trauma, but my focus really is racial trauma, which means, it has to mean, we're talking about collective trauma and we're talking about intergenerational trauma and how do we heal that in community.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'm just thinking about you being led into this healing type work, addressing collective and intergenerational trauma. And I'm thinking about it against the backdrop of community and specifically spiritual communities, or in our conversation, churches, and the role that churches play in forming or helping to reform people who have been impacted by trauma, personal and collective. I can't help but wonder, where do you feel like the deficiency has been in the way people are spiritually formed that on the one allows for such trauma to be perpetuated and then allows for it to be ignored? What is broken in how people are formed that doesn't leave room for the address and the healing from trauma in our spiritual formation?
Yeah, you know, that's a profound question. And I think probably the best way I can answer that is that question is one of the prime reasons why I sit at the intersection I sit, because I believe the answer is in those three things that I mentioned. Number one, we have to decolonize our faith. We have to. If we don't decolonize our faith, we are continuing to internalize and perpetuate a God who is a colonizer, a God who's not just complicit in it, but who authored the idea of it. That ain't the God of the Bible. And that's also not the God of brown Jesus, who was colonized and falsely accused and wrongly imprisoned and then killed by the state. So we have to decolonize how we read scripture, who we understand God to be, and therefore who we understand each other to be and ourselves to be. So that's the first thing, is we've got to decolonize our faith. And when we do, it opens us up to the nature of the faith that Jesus embodied, which is fundamentally liberative. And it's not just spiritually liberative. It is fundamentally liberative. And if we're not actively decolonizing it, we are actively perpetuating the colonizing of people using religion as the vehicle. Look here, there's a reason why Frederick Douglass called Christianity in America the slaveholder's religion. And most of us, quote unquote, Christians in the Western world, especially in the United States, do not understand that the faith most of us inherited is a faith that was literally constructed and manufactured for the sake of justifying the enslaving of human beings that was already happening. Second of all, it's we've got to lead and connect in community in ways that are, I rather use the term neuro-informed instead of trauma-informed, because every single human being has been created by God with the apparatus to heal. Physiologically, our brains, our nervous systems, our bodies are designed to be able to heal. And when you learn these really basic principles of the neuroscience of healing, it changes the way you interact with people, and it fundamentally changes the way you lead people. And then thirdly is beloved community, is the understanding that we heal best in community. We know that not just from scripture, but we know that from science. We know that from neuroscience, that our neural pathways can literally be rewired towards healing and health in relationship. But the caveat to that is that only happens when the relationships are safe, when we feel not judged, when we feel embraced. It's called a corrective experience. And when we're consistently in communities where we feel embraced, seen, accepted, and not judged, our neural pathways rewire according to health and healing. And we begin to see the truth of who we are instead of what the hierarchy of empire has programmed us to believe that we are.
I can so appreciate what you're sharing with us. And I've visited South Africa, I guess it's been about 10 or 12 years. And one of the things that I was struck by was the intentionality of a conscious effort to tell a truthful narrative. So when you talk about this idea of decolonizing our faith, help some of our listeners who may not really understand what that means. Because when I hear that, the first place my mind goes is to, again, trying to get to the truth of the narrative that we tell and not kind of the party line. And I think that that is such an important aspect, particularly now when we're dealing with this faction of Christian nationalism that is like running rampant in the United States right now. And I know that there are a lot of faith leaders who see and hear that, and they're stumped by it because it's so antithetical to Jesus of Nazareth and the faith that we profess. But I think people don't really understand how we refute it or how we come against it or what the work of decolonization looks like in our churches and our communities. So can you help us give some examples of what that work might look like for pastors who find themselves in communities wanting to do that work with their congregations?
Yeah, this is really where the rubber meets the road. So for pastors who want to do this work with their congregations, the number one thing I would say in terms of a place to start is do this work with yourself first and do it with your leadership team first, or at least begin with your leadership team first and then bring the congregation into a journey that you're already on. Mm-hmm. Begin to read, begin to expose yourself to perspectives that are committed to decolonizing. And decolonizing is looking with a particular lens at power dynamics. We're particularly looking at how did current power structures come to be what they are? Who is in the room when decisions are made? How did they get in the room when decisions are made? And perhaps more importantly, who is not in the room when decisions are made? And why are they not in the room when decisions are made? Who does not have a voice? Who does not have a way to influence? Those are the people who become invisible in communities and voiceless. And many times the work of decolonizing, the more that we do it, the more those bodies who have been invisible and the voices who have been silenced begin to bubble to the surface. And we don't realize that we ain't been listening all along. We ain't been seeing them all along.
I can't help but think about how completely relevant this conversation is in this season. I can't remember where I was reading an article about a pastor who preached the Beatitudes and the Sermon on the Mount. And he was immediately accosted by a member of his church who said, "Where did you get those liberal talking points from?" So I hear, again, in a really practical way, the need to reform the lens through which we are reading and interpreting Scripture, which gets back to your original points about the things that need to be done in order to decolonize. You have to read, and you have to read deeply and carefully, especially those who you've been conditioned to ignore.
Yeah. And when we read the text, who are the people in the text that we are not listening for their voice?
Yeah.
Who are the people in the text that have no influence in the way we read?
Yeah.
I do think that part of what we're seeing now in culture in general is what happens when we don't heal.
That's right.
That we kind of get stuck in this cycle of repeating our history and repeating what we've already known and what we've already been through.
Yeah.
And I think that there are certain communities that have to be adaptable and that have had to learn to heal and move forward because we don't have a choice. Marginalized right. communities don't have a choice in adaptability. We don't have the privilege to kind of stay stuck in our ways and stuck in narratives. We're always being challenged and forced to raise to another level and meet a new set of circumstances. And so when we're talking about doing this healing work, can you say a little bit about when we do certain types of work, these neural pathways are triggered and lead to healing? So what are the things that we do? What are the types of practices that we can engage in communities when we want to do this work that helps to trigger and move people further along in their healing?
Yes. Oh, I love this question. My spirit is salivating. Some fundamental things about how the brain changes and how the brain rewires. Many of us in communities of color, and I would argue especially folk in Black American communities. We have, in many ways, been programmed by the system to believe that our value is determined by what we produce. There is a reason for that. We're talking about centuries of our ancestors being enslaved, where the only value they had was what they could produce, how much they could work, how wealthy they could make their enslavers. That gets into the body. That is deep, intense trauma. And the body understands at a subconscious level that if I don't produce, it means suffering. It potentially means death. It potentially means suffering of the people I love most, including my children. It means potentially losing my children or losing my parents as a child. So what we know from science is that 95% of our lives is lived from subconscious belief systems. The decisions we make, the people we surround ourselves with, the jobs that we choose, only 5% is based on our conscious thought.
Wow.
So when we get down into these subconscious belief patterns and we begin to shift them, what you find is people's lives change. They literally change because we're shifting the belief patterns that are determining a lot of the decisions that we make. Mm-hmm. So when we cultivate communities that are intentional about decolonizing and are intentional about cultivating healing space, what begins to happen is those neural pathways begin to shift as long as we're consistently in community and consistently in relationship. And let me just give you a few really practical nuggets. Number one, relationship must be the priority, not rules, definitely not hierarchy. And what one of the tenets in some ways of modern day Western church is your belonging depends on whether or not you can tick all the boxes. If you can't tick all the boxes, you don't belong here. Mm-hmm. That is fundamentally a traumatic space. It deepens trauma because belonging is dependent on performance. When we begin to cultivate communities where relationship comes first, there's a saying, especially in circles that specialize in attachment trauma, connect before you correct. Mm-hmm. That's one example of putting relationship first. Mm-hmm. Another one, which I mentioned earlier, is it has to be a space where people experience, not just know, but they experience, not just hear with words, but experience that they can come in as all of who they are and not be judged. Mm-hmm. The moment people experience judgment, the brain goes into stress response. The frontal lobe gets in some ways locked down. And the frontal lobe is where we have our logic and our reasoning, and we can calculate information and make decisions. Mm-hmm. When you go into what we call trauma brain, which is what happens in a stress response, that frontal lobe is in many ways offline. Mm-hmm. So in many of our churches and many of our faith communities, you got people walking around with their frontal lobe totally offline.
Yeah.
As someone who has lived in a majority world country and community for a decade, the majority of the world cultivates communities that are relationship-centered. We should be the students of those communities. So really what we're trying to do in terms of communities of color, we're trying to get back to who we really are.
Wow.
We're trying to get back to our ancestral values that were always there.
Ubuntu.
And have been stripped.
Yeah.
Because of hierarchy and empire.
Wow. Well, somebody got their lesson today.
Yeah, for sure.
Thank you, Dr. G.
Awesome.
Thank you, Jen, for jumping on this podcast today. It's a gift. I hope that our listeners are realizing what they've been entrusted with. So thank you. And I can't wait for us to do this again.
My dear siblings, it has been an honor and a complete joy to be with you today. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Ministry Collaborative Podcast,
a project of the Macedonian Ministry Foundation.
The Ministry Collaborative nurtures a national network
of pastors and congregations
committed to faithful,
creative,
and courageous engagement in their communities.
Our producer is Marthane Sanders.
To find out more about our work of cultivating leadership that makes a difference
in congregations and communities,
visit our website
at www.ministrycollaborative.org.